the similar subjects or an opposite subject, but they were fascinated with what the other were doing. Also, one of the big places where students would usually get to know each other was on going on tour. We'd get into the bus and a boy and girl sit down next to each other and they get to know each other. And it was very interesting to see how these love affairs would bloom. And I was sort of a father confessor, I guess, and they would come in often and ask me, what do you think of so-and-so? Do you think she's a fine girl, or is he a fine young man? Of course, all the students with whom I worked, I always thought they were fine people, and they were. And I had much faith, very much faith in every student with whom I worked. I found that the people who didn't want to work and didn't want to go through a, well, in quotes, a certain discipline, those are the ones that eliminated themselves from our choir, which was all right. And I believe I mentioned before in one of our conversations that I wanted these people to try to establish, along with their music, have some sort of good way of living and have these 4 years at the college certainly were formative years where they're going to go out into the world. After you go to graduate school, students who have come back to me say it's altogether different than undergraduate study, and it certainly is. So we had just this tremendous feeling of a big family and getting to know each other. And then also some of the students who were officers of the choir would work together on projects that we had to get done. Now, there's one thing that I always did in my choir. Now, this may be a little bit aside. We worked together quite closely, the students and I did. However, I realized that they were young and they were in their formative years, and I often gave them, fatherly advice. I felt that they needed some guidance. You just can't give a project in the choir to a student and say, now you get this done, because I've run into many problems. We had a business manager for our tours 1 year, and that was a total flop, because the sponsors would say, well, I don't want to deal with this young student, I want to deal with you, because we want to be sure that this is going to happen. Well, I had a very capable young man as a business manager 1 year, and we almost had a total flop of our touring, particularly because the sponsors didn't want to deal with him. So we eliminated all that. And in other words, what I'm trying to say is that some people have accused me of being very much of a dictator. That was not really true, because I was more giving them guidance in what we were doing. And I don't think that we could have worked as efficiently as we do, and we did away with a lot of sloppiness. For example, here's just a real minor point. In September, the students would know exactly where we're going to go the whole year. I had everything planned, and I was very much interested. One of my students, one of my really fine students, who was very artistic, came by to visit with me a couple of weeks ago, and his name is Kevin Walters from Salem, Virginia, very artistic, and he did all our posters. And he told me, he said he remembers how we talked the first week in September about our posters for Christmas and for spring and for tour. And we would work on it. He laughed. He said, Pappy, I'd bring you a sketch, and you'd look at it, and I'd look at it, and we'd look at it, and we'd start laughing. And then we'd sit down very seriously, and we'd throw our ideas together. And then we would test some of our other students, some of the officers, as well just the general student in the choir, and any of them that had any artistic inclinations would pool our thoughts and come up with a pretty good, a real fine poster. But I just this say, they'd always come and say, well, what do you think about this? And we pool our ideas. And I think this is the way a good choir, only a good choir can function that way. I grant you that students are very talented and very creative and all that, but they still need a little help from the elders. Just like sometimes some of my students would come in and complain about their parents, which would really upset me. And they would talk about their father's old man and their mother's old lady, and I'd stop them all and say, now just a minute, let's back up here. Let's play this tape back and erase that. I said, your father is your father, and your mother is your mother who sacrificed to bring you to school. And I used to preach to them. And they always, I mean, I'd always finish up and say, we won't have an offertory today. Well, I don't know. This is about the way a lot of these students, of course, they got to know each other quite well because we felt as if we were just a big family.
Mm-hmm. That's very good. We figured out a minute ago that the choir must have performed about 1,000 concerts. What was the appeal that you felt the William & Mary Choir did have?
Well, first let me tell you about the various concerts we have, and then I'll tell you what our appeal was.
Right.
We had formal concerts on the campus, such as the Christmas concerts, which we usually gave two or three nights a week, and the spring concerts the same way, and then once in a while we would have other formal things or events for which we had to perform. Then we had tour concerts, and on the tours, not only did we give formal concerts at night, but we would go to high schools and sing for assembly programs. We felt that this was a good public relation work for the college because it would show students. In fact, several of the students, I remember this one girl that was going to go to Duke University, but she heard us. And so she applied to William & Mary, and she really came to be a member of the choir, and she worked awfully hard, and for a while she wasn't sure if she's going to make it. And that was one of the, she told me that she comes back, and she always tells me that was one of the happiest moments of her life because of the music that we sang and the training she got other than just music. Then also, in the early days, when I came, we had chapel services every Wednesday night, and the choir had to sing for that. And that got to be sort of a burden for the students because the general student, didn't come. Many times we had more people in the choir than students attending the chapel. So several years ago, before I retired, I went to Dean Lambert, and I told him that we felt that we didn't mind singing for chapel if other students would come. So he said he would study it, and he studied it, and he said that he didn't think the choir should be forced to go to chapel if we don't, require the other students to go to chapel also. And of course, this was several years ago before we had this expression of personal rights and individual rights and so on. My students in the days that they were required to go to chapel never did really strike anything like that because they knew this was part of their duty as a member of the choir. And so we had convocations and chapel services and special events. Graduation, and the students were required to sing for that. And we never knew from time to time what we would have, but they would inform me, and then we would get ready for it. And in the 29 years that I was at William & Mary, I'm sure that we performed close to 1,000 formal concerts and special events and tour concerts. Now, The thing that I think in a college such as this, when most of the students in the choir
did this as an extracurricular activity and a relief from their study. Therefore, I always plan my programs a little more differently than if I was teaching in a conservatory or a school of music. And of course, there were people that had criticized me and our choir for the type of program that I presented to the audiences. I always told my students that we sort of build our program like as a meal. We have the main course, and we have little side dishes, and then finally we have the dessert. And not that the lighter numbers were the dessert, but the point I want to make is that you have a full round program, because we did some of the finest literature, choral literature, that was ever written, and we did some with orchestra, we did some with various instrumental groups. Mr. Stewart and Mr. Barner were very fine and always helping us where we needed orchestra or just an instrumental group. And the amazing thing about this whole business was that our choral groups always memorized everything, and people would just stand in amazement that they would learn some of these difficult things that we did. We did the Monte Verdi Magnificat, of course. We did the Messiah. We did the Dirge's Requiem. We did the music of Salve Maria Kulank, and Gloria Bat Kulank, and we did the Lord of the Nativity, where it's speed. We did the Two Saints of Cecilia by Delagio, Schick's All Sleep of Brahms. Oh, well, I just can't remember it. We gave them good, solid music. We did shorter motets and things like that. Then we did folk songs of various types, and then we did some light numbers. And I want to say right here, do some of these light numbers. We didn't spend the amount of time in learning them as we did some of these heavier numbers, but they still had to be done with some spark. Mm-hmm. And one of the hardest things in my career really was to find a library that the students would like, the audience would like, and also be an educational experience. And I don't care what these high-browed critics would say about us, you teach something in anything that you give your students. And nothing is wasted time, because I think you learn from every experience you have. As I used to tell my students, don't gripe about a certain professor. You may learn something that you shouldn't do after you get out. And I, in my own experiences, I found so many things that I would not do to my students or require my students by having had a professor who was unreasonable. The type of program we would sing, so many times to find the good arrangement, I would look at the, I would spend my summers during the time I wasn't paid. I'd be at the office anyway. I worked for the college 12 months a year, and it was on a 10-month basis salary. I didn't gripe about it. I enjoyed this, and I was always thinking of my student and also what I could do, and I would plan ahead for what we'd have for the entire year. In fact, I had sort of a 5-year plan. I'd look through music and I'd stack it. And I'd say, well, and it depends upon the type of voices that you have. Some years you were blessed with more men students, and always we were very fortunate to have some very fine ladies, and they sang very well. Whereas we weren't the best choir in the world, we worked hard and tried to do the best we could. Now, also, what we did in our presentation, if you want to, I call it a sort of working out the logistics for a presentation. That's the setting up the physical appearance of the stage, and also working out an appearance of the students, that when they got in front of the group, I don't know if I mentioned this before, we often a lot of mothers and dads would drag to these concerts because their darling sons and daughters were in there. I'm not making fun of them, but that you can understand a parent is proud of a student being in the choir, their son or daughter. And I always would say, if they don't like what we sing and the music that we sing, they can always say, well, they did look pretty. And we had I will never forget, we sang in Petersburg, Virginia, one night, and this man said that he came to me after the concert, and he says, Dr. Fair, I was dragged to this. I didn't want to go to this, but my wife said that I had to go, and I'm not sure whether or not his daughter's son was in the group, but I think there were friends in me. And for an encore, we sang a really quite difficult version of St. Louis Blues. And I know that some people, again, the highbrow musician would holler about it. But the thing that we improved on this number. What I mean by that, we used the arrangement and sort of brought in some of our own creativity. And the students learned, if they learned nothing else, after all, Handy was an American composer. There were a lot of rhythmic problems in there. And little nuances that we put in there. In other words, it was a real educational experience for him. I can't get over, I guess I'm very naive, but I just feel that some of these people should know all types of literature, you see. I have some very intelligent friends. The first thing they do in the morning, look at the funny paper. Well, good lands. If you're going to get so picky-unish about your music, I think that's pretty bad. So we had, I know that people said all we did is put on a show, but the thing that we always stress that you must sing well, you must sing the music to the best of your ability. And with the talent, I'm not criticizing William and Mary, but with the talent that comes here, because we are basically a liberal arts college. Mm-hmm. And I tell them, we have sort of a standing joke among our students, and when things weren't going too well in rehearsals sometimes, I always control my temper. I never tried to scold the student, except I never was sarcastic unless I had to be. Once in a while I had to be, which my students also corroborate with me that you'd get some, quote, smart aleck students, and some of the students would know more than the director, and we'd always say, well, we'd buy them a ticket to the Metropolitan. With tongue in cheek, when we'd have a bad rehearsal, I'd often say to them, ladies and gentlemen, well, why'd you come to William & Mary? You remember you came first to sing in the choir and second to study. But really, we didn't mean that. we meant that they should do their college work and then sing in the choir. To show you that how interested I was in these students, I would ask them for their grades. Sometimes I would, when I wasn't sure about some of the grades, I know this sounds, I've told the students that I would go back to their records and look at them. Because after all, as I mentioned a few moments ago, Dad, Ma, Mother are spending a lot of money on you to come to college, and you got to do your job in your classes. And when students, oftentimes I wouldn't take people on tour because they didn't have strong enough grades. A lot of times tour helped people's grades, because I've had many students come to me because I'd insisted that I'd find out what their grades were before they'd go on tour, that if they weren't strong enough. And these students, several students told me that their grades went up as a result of their going on tour. They would take the books along and do some studying on tour. To show you that people were interested in our concert, there was a travel bureau in Dayton, Ohio, that wrote to the Colony Williamsburg and saying that they were coming to Williamsburg. They were bringing two busloads of people. And they asked whether or not there was anything interesting happening, and this was around Christmas time. So they wrote back and sent them this week in Williamsburg, and then they mentioned also that around Christmas time the William Mary Choir, of course, would do the Christmas concert. Well, they decided that they would buy 100 tickets. And they came, expecting an ordinary Christmas concert with the usual procedure. And people came after the concert and told us they were just overwhelmed at the Christmas concert that they had experienced. And they said,
far as they were concerned, their Christmas was over now because they had it here. And the students and I, of course, felt very happy about that. I know that's a small group, but and then the next year, one busload came, and they were very much very appreciative of the efforts of our students. We had parents who would come for a distance. It's always was amazing to me what parents would do for their sons and daughters. We had people to even fly in from California for a concert, and from New England states, and Pennsylvania, and Florida, and it was just amazing. I just could not get over that. Fine, rewarding comments that some of the people gave to both the students and to me. They would often go to the students and speak to them after the concert, and this one man came to me after one of the concerts and said, he didn't know me, he didn't know the squire before, but he noted the dignity, the discipline, the precision, the beauty of singing, the accuracy and the appearance. He said that it was absolutely, that he sat there with the greatest amazement. He said when the concert was over, he decided that he would like to sit there for another hour or two to listen some more. This always, of course, was a big shot in the arm for our students because they felt like working hard, that it was worth, we strove for as much excellence as we possibly could get. And I know that there, again, we decided that the people who were jealous of us would be our worst critics. We were never critical of other people. We would observe them, and we'd say we wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. And it was no unchristian-like attitude that we had to them, but we tried to do something that had appeal and also was a musical education, a musical and an educational experience for the students as well as for those people who listened to us.
And you yourself spent a lot of time working out these logistics and stage directions, I know.
In the concert of 1972 for Christmas, one night after dinner, I told my wife that I was going to, don't want to be bothered, don't want to even be called at the phone. And I sat down at 7 o'clock, and I didn't move out of my chair until 12 o'clock midnight, because I had close to 200 people to get in, to do in a procession to get in and get them, I worked and worked. I mean, it sounds stupid, I'm sure, to people who have never done this, but to make the thing click. See, the thing is this, I always tell my students, the audience will notice any mistake you make. Yeah, I said it's the same way when you do something at home bad, your mother and dad will scold you, and when you do something good, they very seldomly praise you. And I said the same thing is true in our concerts. I said if we do something sloppy and inaccurate and sing poorly, people are going to talk about it. But I told them I just like for them to sit, have the audience to sit back and be relaxed and that you are in singing and with some confidence and putting across the number beautifully and artistically as possible.
This is on concerts. Right. How was it that you hit upon singing, starting your concert by singing America the Beautiful?
Well, one thing that we believed in our concerts was the business of being OT, on time. Because so many times people would go to concerts and they sit there and wait and wait and wait, and then it would start maybe 15, 20 minutes late. And I guess that's fashionable. But I told my people that if we're going to say we start at 8:15, let's start at 8:15. So we were pretty much on time with most of our concerts, excepting when the box office called back and said, hold it a few minutes, some people are straggling in. So I, for a long time, wanted to get something to start our concerts, particularly our spring concerts with the, we started our Christmas concerts many times with the procession. And that made these people who came in late stand back there and miss all this procession. The procession really was quite beautiful because it was very well timed. And a
again, some people say you all were just like a military group. Well, it's much better than that than wobbling down the aisle like a duck or bouncing around and kids hitting each other's hips and so forth. And then it was really very, very beautifully done and with a lot of precision. We started the spring concert. We tried to find something where we could sing to open up the concert and then stop and let the stragglers get to their places. And after the I thought of using the Star Spangled Banner, but I'd made quite a few arrangements by the choir, which are not really very useful to anybody else. Nobody would want to use it. But I had worked out a preamble going into the Star Spangled Banner, but that didn't really prove satisfactory. So we hit on America the Beautiful, and you'd be surprised. I made an arrangement of that, how the audience immediately, they felt why. They were part of us. In other words, there was a rapport between the choir and the audience, and the other thing I said, that it gave us a chance for the latecomers, after we sing America the Beautiful, we'd stop, and I'd turn around and just look at the audience until I saw everybody seated, and then we'd go on with our formal program. So it worked very well, and people enjoyed it because, as I say, somebody who would come to the program because he was or she was dragged there, she could go back and say, well, I did know America the Beautiful. It's funny, people do like to hear a few things that they know. They really do. And I don't think that's bad, because you can, at that same concert, you can introduce them to other things. My wife has often said it's too bad that the people couldn't hear our concerts two or three times, because she would go along on tour as a chaperone and also hear the concerts here, and she went to all of them. And so one time I said to her, well, all right, we gave three concerts here, and we gave about six or seven concerts on the road. What's that, nine? Six and three, nine. I said, haven't you gotten enough? She says, no. She says, every concert I hear something new. And that's really true. And and also the students really learn their music well that way, and it's not a forgotten event. One of my students who graduated in 1968 came by to see me recently, and he started singing his part in Schicksalslied for Brahms, and he didn't know any German, and that was very interesting. And I said, Bill, you still remember it? He said, I'll never forget it. He said, how could I forget it? We learned it so well. Incidentally, last night a student came by to see me, and she said to me that, she used to get so mad at me because I would say, well, all right, we'll go back and do this again, both from the standpoint of presentation and also from the standpoint of singing the music. And she says, but now, she says, I don't know why I got mad, because I see how much I learned and how much I've retained. And since she's graduated, she's tried various church choirs. And she said she went to a church choir just recently in which they were doing the Hallelujah Chorus from the Mount of Olives, which is a Bedouin, which is not really too hard, but it still has to be done with some precision and accuracy. And she said that she left that church choir, and now she's looking for another one, because the choir director said, well, after we sing this number, we'll go back to some of these good old gospel songs again, which is really good music. And that killed her too, because I'm not criticizing gospel songs, but I think that in the churches you should have a high standard of literature also.
Okay, well, we've been talking about some of the concerts that you've done, but I know you also did a number of special concerts too.
Well, Miss Williams, I think we thought anything that we did was special, and we didn't have any particular level of this is better than this and so on, because I had instilled in my students that anything we do was special, whether or not it was just singing for 10 or 15 people. And we have done that. I've been invited to some small gatherings where we did sing for a small audience. But I suppose what you have in mind in this is such as the, when we did the Ode to the Virginian Voyage, composed by Randall Thompson in 1957, of course, this particular event meant, really was sort of special for us because this was a premiere performance. We did this performance along with the Norfolk Symphony under direction of Edgar Schenkman and the Norfolk Civic Chorus. And there were some 250 singers, and Randall Thompson himself was here for the performance. We did the performance on the campus in 5-8 on April the 1st, 1957, and then we went to Norfolk on April the 7th to sing this. And what was interesting about the Ode to the Virginian Voyage, Mr. Thompson, there are 7 movements, as I recall, in the work. And he'd compose a movement or two, and he'd send them to us, and then we'd be sitting waiting for the next movement to come. And it was we had a lot of fun because we were always sitting in anticipation, what's the next movement going to be like? And sixth movement, I think there's 6 or 7 movements, I'm sorry, I can't remember at the moment, but the movement which has a fugue in it is very, very difficult. And many choruses, when they sing this, omit that, and it's a very challenging movement. But the interesting thing that we enjoyed so much is that Mr. Thompson came down to hear us rehearse his music, and he stood back in the rehearsal room, and we were rehearsing in Mule 100 at that time, and he had stood back there with his arms folded, and once in a while he'll scowl, and then all of a sudden he'd smile. And when we were finished with the singing, I said, Mr. Thompson, did you do something wrong? He said, well, no, he says, I didn't mean this to be like this. I heard it when I was writing it. See, he had never heard it. He was writing it. And the students were amazed that a composer could do that. And then he says, other things that he thought would sound differently just sounded so beautifully to him. And he said he didn't really scowl because we did it badly. He said he blamed himself. And we made a few changes in the score, not many, but it was very interesting to have him on the reservation to hear us work on this. And then, of course, Mr. Schenkman came up to listen to our choir to see how we were getting along. One interesting little byline of this was that when we sang it here, we had memorized the whole work, and the Norfolk chorus didn't. And when we were working on placement and putting the group on the 5-8 stage, and this was a huge group because we had the orchestra and we had the singers. So Mr. Shenton, since our young ladies all had black skirts and white blouses and red sashes and so forth, and looked very formal. And since his singers were pretty much dressed alike, except they weren't all the same as our choir, he asked all the William Mary choir girls to be on the front row and then bring a picture. And of course, all the men wore tuxes and made a nice picture. But after the overture, when we started the second movement, overture going into the movement where the choirs start singing with the orchestra, he gave a signal to open the books, and my girls had the books in their hands, but they never brought them up. And I forgot to tell him that we had memorized it, that we weren't going to use the books. And it, first, he said, he came to me after the performance, first performance, and he said, my, I was worried. I didn't know what's going to happen. He said, those girls didn't open up the books. But he said, I watched them for a few measures, and I saw they were singing just with all their enthusiasm possible. And he said, then he decided we had it memorized, which we did. And, of course, we had a lot of a laugh out of that, because when he came up to rehearse with us, we had the books in front of us because he pointed out things, and he said, "Let's sing this." After each movement, he said, "Well," he says, "Dr. Barrett, I'm nothing I can say to you. You people got this down, because we try to learn it just as accurately as possible and sing it just as well as we possibly could." So that was one of our special. Yeah, another special event that for which we performed was for the Women's Auxiliary of the American Legion, and we did that, I think this was in February 1969, and our touring choir did that, and this was the time when we had a semester break, and the touring choir had come back a little earlier, but they didn't mind. They were enjoyed doing this because we stayed at the old Sheraton Park Hotel in Washington. I think that's the place it was. The way this came about, when I was in Austin, Texas, I taught a student piano. And after I left Austin, we...
Wait a second.
She called me long distance, and I didn't know what the world had at this moment. I didn't, well, I recognized her as soon as I, but I was so surprised. She told me that she had now lived in Indianapolis and was the executive secretary for the Women's Auxiliary of the American Legion. And she said that they wanted some good music and asked us if we'd sing at their convention in the auxiliary. And I said, I had always checked with my students if they wanted to accept the invitation. And of course, when I told them about it, then all our expenses would be paid, and we didn't have to miss any college because we were just in, it was in between the semesters. And so we went up and gave a performance, and they gave us a standing ovation at the end of the performance. And at that time, there were some members of the Freedom's Foundation, Valley Forge there. So about a month, a little bit later, I got this long distance call from them and asked and said that they heard our program, were very much impressed with it, well, and they'd like to have us to sing for their, they're going to have a special occasion in which they honored the late General Dwight D. Eisenhower. And at the Mayflower Hotel was a sort of banquet and also occasion for a ceremony. And they asked for a patriotic program. And I set to work with my students, and we had came up with the idea of tying together a with the narration a patriotic program, mm-hmm. which really was received very, very well by the Freedom's Foundation and the people that were there. It was the narration was in the main written by one of our students, Larry Rakin, who is now is working on in New York with some opera company, light opera company, doing particularly Gilbert and Sullivan things in New York. Incident that really amused my students was that I had worked out a medley of patriotic sounds of the various branches of the armed forces, like the Merchant Marine, Army, Navy, Air Force, and every time we'd get to their particular song, they'd all rise and clap, and the students in the choir were not ready for that. They didn't know it's going to happen. But they got the biggest bang out of that, and then various other things. And then, of course, what we did, I know it was a little sentimental, but we had the young men, and we worked out an arrangement of the taps that we honored those in connection. Since it was honoring the late General Eisenhower, we also included the men who gave up their lives for the services. That was really a very, very touching. sentimental as it turned out to be, because there were some parents there whose sons were killed in Vietnam, and it was really quite touching, and the room was very, very quiet, and from the taps the young men sang Eternal Father, and the name of the song, and that was beautifully done. But however, we picked up the tempo, and it was really a very exciting program for the audience that was there.
That'll be fine. And you were saying to me that your performance at this Freedoms Foundation dinner made quite an impact on the audience.
Yes. Let me tell you, this was very interesting. The students always sensed the attitude and the tempo of the people there. Well, we walked in this huge room, auditorium of the Mayflower Hotel in Washington to give our performance, and people were noisy, and some didn't even pay attention, and as we went on our rises, we got a small, polite welcome with some little applause, and the people were somewhat noisy, and I realized when we were going to go there that we were going to have something like that, so I wrote a prologue and started on a unison note, and very strong. We did this a cappella, and it was really amazing. How noisy they were, and as soon as we hit the first note and sang "We the People of the United States of America," everybody, you could just almost cut the silence. And we did that, and went into our program, and went from the prologue into the Star Spangled Banner. And after we sang that, we just received a hearty applause. Immediately we won the audience, and then we went on with our patriotic program. And incidentally, this program was also in honor of some retiring generals and admirals, and a chaplain who had given the invocation at the various Senate sessions. Then another event which we thought was very special, which was an outgrowth of our performances for the American Women's Auxiliary of American Legion and the Freedoms Foundation, was that we were contacted by the DAR for one of their national conventions, and that brought people from all over the United States, of course, chiefly women, but we sang in the Constitution Hall, and I tell you right now, we had one of the most beautiful settings and a beautiful place to sing, and we were overwhelmingly received there, and there were between 3,000 to 4,000 people there. It was quite a thrill for our students, and as we stood on the stage and of course, we started with either "America Beautiful" or this arrangement I had of the Star Spangled Banner. I don't recall at the moment. And what was very interesting at each one of our performances at these big conventions and the occasions that we received a standing ovation with a huge applause, which the students didn't expect, but the people came to us and. For example, you asked a moment ago about the impact they had at the Freedoms Foundation. I had people come to me and just jump up after we finished our program and they said, "I came from this university or that university. I thought we had a fine choir. And why isn't this choir better known in the United States?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. We just sing and we try to do a good performance when we go out." It was quite satisfying to our choir members and myself that we had made a favorable impression for the College of William and Mary in Virginia, and also for us and people comment on the fine performance that those students did. Well, I don't say they were perfect, and unfortunately I was never satisfied. I always told we could do better. I said to my students many times, "Well, when I get through here on earth, that when I get to heaven, if they're going to ask me to be a choir director, I'm going to say no. But I'll polish the harps and freak with the angels, because I tell you, I've really worked here on earth."
One way that the choir did become known, though, was through the Christmas TV programs they did. How was it that Cain and William Mary Choir was put on national TV?
Well, again, somebody had heard our choir, And we were one of the TV stations. I'm not sure if it was WVEC, Channel 13, all of these, but we were on television from 1964, 65, 66, 67, and 68. And we always worked out a very, we think, a very good program that would hold the attention of a TV audience as well. We didn't give up quality and of library and singing just because we wanted to please somebody. However, the TV stations insisted that we give the audience something that they will make people feel like they are Christmassy. I can understand that. I think there's a place for everything, and at Christmas time, let's face it, people, it's a joyous time, and you want to bring something, and in the music should also give some elation to people. To show you what has really interested us was the program that we made in 1968. A station in Los Angeles still carries at prime time on December the 24th and December the 25th. They show it. And for years, for 68, 69, 70, 71, they always called for our tape. And of course, we were very happy. We let it, let them have it. And so in 72, the man called me long distance, said, ask whether or not I would allow them to make a copy of it. Well, I didn't make any difference. In fact, I was kind of honored that they wanted our program. And they show it every year, and I get letters from people, and the only thing I told them, I said that they should say this is a repeat, because some of the students now look very young in their haircuts, and the fashions is just a little bit different than what they were are in the present time. But they told, I did get a letter from them, and they said that this program had one of the most interest at Christmas time than any program that they had shown. And it was really quite, we had to find a man Mr. Lindsay Tucker from WVEC, he really enjoyed the students, and they enjoyed him, and we worked together, and we made things click. What we would do is make the audio first, and he'd come up and listen to it, we'd make the audio fairly early and show him what we had worked out. Now, we started working on those TV programs the year ahead, thinking we'd have, he and I would have conferences together, how are we going to do this and so on. But one of the, in 1968, I was really, hard moment for me there for a while, because he said we had some good music, and he says Pappy, he says, this is not going to go over. He says, you do this beautiful and do this, but this is not what we have in mind. We'd like to have this and this. So we had to sit down within 2 or 3 weeks, at least we had 3 weeks, to learn a couple of things that they wanted, and we worked them out. And it really worked out very beautifully, and the students were quite excited about it too. But the point I'm trying to make is, sure, you can give them Bach and Beethoven and Brahms and all of that, but they, let's face it, they still want to hear some Christmassy things. So we had quite a few folk tunes, and then we ended the program with carols. And the way we ended the 1968 program was that made a big long fire outside, and they had candles, and we did this at night, and they shot these students through the fire, and you could see them through the shimmering flame, and with the Wren building in the back with the candles. And then as we left the scene, we would walk out, and then we hummed Silent Night and sang it, and then hummed it, and the announcer made the announcement. announcement about the program, and it was really quite effective. I know it was a little bit on the showmanship side, and after all, a TV audience, they want to hear something Christmassy at Christmas, I think. I still like to hear Silent Night. I know it sounds silly. Some people hate it. Well, you're never going to bat 1,000%. You're going to always have some problem. Well, these programs, and it took a terrific amount of work. We would start as of 10 o'clock in the morning, for example, to be shooting, and we'd finish up at 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and for half an hour program. What we would do is go through a segment and then stop another segment. And a lot of times we'd get just about at the end of this little segment, which may be 3 or 4 minutes, and they say, cut, go back. And the students, the thing I always did, I always warned my students, I said, now, ladies and gentlemen, you've got one of the hardest things in the world you're going to do. You're going to have to, because we're not going to put this on sloppily. We're not going to say, oh, that's good enough. My choir has never said, oh, that's good enough. They had to get, and they got this idea, too, that things had to be done with as much excellence and perfection. I always pointed out to them, remember, they're thinking of the College of William and Mary in Virginia. And also they're thinking about you as a choir, and the choir director and so on. That choir is a whole lot like a football team. When the football team wins, oh man, isn't the football team great? But soon they started to kill the coach. And the same thing is true with the choir. The choir doesn't really do a good job. It's a sloppy job and things that don't interest people. They say, why don't you get a new choir director? Well, that's the way life is. Let's face it. Another thing that we felt quite honored is that we were on the series. I don't know if whether or not it's as popular now as it was several years ago. It was a great college choirs in America, and that was a radio program. And we did some recording for that, and we did this program was sent all over the United States. And then we were asked to make a program for overseas radio to the armed forces. And it was interesting, the one former William and Mary student, and there wasn't a choir, said he was in his bunk over in Germany, and he was listening to the radio, and all of a sudden it says, choir of the College of William and Mary, Virginia, will now present a Christmas concert. He said it really meant a lot to him that Christmas to hear our choir from the college to which he went. It really, you never know where you reach, and so many people hear you and they never react to it, but some people do take time to write you, and that of course is always very stimulating and encouraging to the students who really have spent hours and hours learning music.
I believe you even said that one time your choir sang at a wedding for some fellow choir members.
Oh yes, in 1972, because as we pointed out earlier, there were many, many romances, some of which ended in marriage and others that burned to a crisp like a piece of toast. But this young lady and young gentleman were married in the latter part of May just before graduation, and they were seniors. Good choir people, and so I don't remember really how it came along. I think in jest I just say, why don't you have the choir sing for your wedding? So they took me up on it. So what we did, I worked out with the minister out there at the, we sang at the wedding was at Walnut Hills Baptist Church, and the ministers were the Reverend Jerry Haywood, and he and I sat down and worked out art of services for the wedding, and then we got with the couple and showed them what we had worked out, and they approved everything. It was a very, very beautiful wedding. Anyway, we think so because we were part of it. Mm-hmm. The way they started, we had there was some prenuptial music, and then the choir went into the loft and sang three prenuptial numbers, and really they did it quite beautifully done. And then the organist continued playing the prenuptial music, and the choir retired to the back of the church, and then the choir sang the processional, and the wedding party followed. And then within the service, one of the members masters and Max Smith sang the Lord's Prayer because that was requested by the family. And then at the end, when the couple was kneeling, at the end of the choir sang, "The Lord bless you and keep you." And really, that brought tears to a lot of the people in the audience, because it was a really very, very beautiful service. And then the choir stayed in the choir loft and sang the processional. And they sang, for the processional, sang, "Joyful, joyful, we adore thee." Mm-hmm. And for the recessional, they sang, "Now thank we all our God." And it really was a beautiful occasion. And these two students, I see them every now and then, and they write me, and I always mention how much that has meant to them in their life.
Okay, well, shall we stop for today?
Yes.
Okay. December 10th, 1975. Testing, testing, testing. There was one more special event, Dr. Fair, you said you wanted to include that the choir sang for, and what was that?
We sang at the First Baptist Church, which is a black church. At that time, it was located on Nassau Street here in Wilderness. And at some time, I think it was the early 1950s, when we were singing there, and we gave those people one of our programs. They asked us to come down, and we sang for them several times. And of course, we presented our entire program, and then towards the end, we sang a spiritual. And much to the amazement of my choir members, all of a sudden, the whole congregation started to sing with us, and it was a very delightful surprise. And of course, these black people really had the rhythm, and inspired us to have that rhythm pretty right. And it was a real educational experience for us.
Now, we wanted today to talk about the facilities the choir worked with, the rehearsal and the auditorium facilities that you found in the 29 years you were director of the William & Mary Choir.
Yes. When I came to William & Mary in 1945, space was sort of limited for rehearsal. The head of the department at that time sort of suggested we practice in the Wren Chapel. At that time, the Wren Building wasn't on the visitors list as much as it is now, but I didn't particularly like the rehearsal facilities in the Wren Chapel, so I asked him for some other rehearsal room, and we did rehearse in the basement of the Methodist Church. And at that time, the choir met Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and the band met Tuesdays and Thursdays, so we shared the basement of the Methodist Church, which is on Duke of Gloucester Street. Of course, now it is the Methodist Church has moved out on Jamestown Road, and the Methodist Church has been used for other matters. It was enjoyable to practice there. People would come and sit in the windows and listen to us, and the students would get a big bang out of that. And of course, we made beautiful sounds coming out of particularly around Christmas season, when we were singing Christmas music, people would listen to us. Not only that, but also all seasons when the windows were open. Then after, from the Methodist Church, where we moved out there, we moved over to the what is now the President's Office and Admissions Office. And we practiced in those three rooms, and that was a little bit difficult because the rooms were so live. However, it was nice because that was the old 5-8 Capitol building, and we could go into the use a stage sometimes when the theater wasn't practicing. However, the stage on old 5-8 Capitol was almost impossible for us to get our group on stage, and they had built a sub stage a few feet lower than the main stage, and so we were able to expand ourselves over the front part of old 5-8. Then after the old 5-8 burned and became, and Ewell Hall was built, we were assigned to Ewell 100, which is a nice large room. We were on the first floor and the band on the second floor. However, we had problems because the band started practicing Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. We'd have some strange harmonies going on with the band practicing upstairs and the choir downstairs. So we tried to change our times of rehearsal, but we did have some overlapping. One of the worst things was that the heavy drum beat coming through the heating or ventilating system, and sometimes we'd sing very softly, and all of a sudden you'd have this big blast coming from the band. I'm not criticizing them, it's just one of those things where we had to deal with, and oftentimes when we make recordings, I would work out with Mr. Varner that if we could adjust our times so that we wouldn't have a background of band music and with our choral music, which we're probably not in the same key also. While Old Five Bait was burned down, we had no auditorium, we sang our concerts in the Blow Gym, and that was sort of something because we had to reconstruct and build our stage. We did some things. We had even some of the students from the theater who were very kind to us built some flats and painted them and did that. And we gave our Christmas program in Blow Gym, people sitting on bleachers, and of course we put some chairs down also. We did a little showmanship with concerts there. We started our Christmas concert with a fanfare from the balcony, and oh, everybody enjoyed that, and then we did a procession going into the on the stage, and had some sort of intricate movements which were very effective. People came to me and told me how beautiful the look when we used the candles, lights at Christmas at first. A little sentimental probably and so on, but however, I think if you don't bring joy to people with the music, you're losing a big point in music. You don't just sing things always that people may like, but you do and give a big variety of music. Then did I mention that we gave concerts in the Methodist Church and the Baptist Church was the Williamsburg Baptist Church was very nice. We did some recording and we did some practicing with the organ there at the Baptist Church. Since I was the choir director and organist at the Baptist Church, the minister and the congregation were very kind to us to let us practice there. And of course the Methodist Church was very good to us to let us come in there and give some of our programs and cooperate with the college. Now on tour, we really had some unusual experiences. We always tried to sing in a high school auditorium or in an auditorium with the stage, but that wasn't always possible. So we had most unusual places where we had to set up. We set up our choir much differently than some people. We build up our choir sometimes 8-9 rows high, and of course we had to have people who were not scared to stand on the upper levels. We used to have sort of a standing joke among ourselves that we were going to put a parachute on people so that in case they fall. And we've had one or two kind of close calls with some people. They never did tell us that. Well, one young man, a real healthy, strong-looking young fellow, just about fainted and fell from the top. And as we were singing one number, we kept on singing. We never stopped, but I got word to my, just talking with my lips, and they caught the message. And I said, catch this fellow, he's going to fall. And they just did catch this fellow, otherwise he'd have fallen about 7 or 8 feet, and that could have been really tragic. But the rest of the choir didn't know about it because they were paying attention to me. They didn't look around, and the audience was more excited than we were. And they were amazed. They just took the boy out, and we kept on going with our number. And people were amazed that we could do that. Well, we were trained so well that under any circumstance. I had told the group that if any time anything like that would happen, just somebody would take care of it. We had another incident where, luckily, this young fellow was on the
front row, and auditoriums are the hottest places that you can possibly sing in. And you may want to delete this from my conversation with you, but I said it gets hotter than Baptist hell. And they would come to me. They would, a lot of times the singers would be soaking wet and after a concert, because the auditoriums where we're singing, I don't know why architects have designed auditoriums that way. And well, anyway, we were singing this concert, and this boy, boom, he fell. And we were doing a number where the part of the choir was, we're doing echo chorus. And the people who did the echo chorus didn't know what happened. They thought, they didn't know what, it was a terrific band. So I just signaled to a couple of my boys to take this young man off the stage. And so there happened to be a doctor in the auditorium, and he went around and came to see this boy. And we got a big bang out of this, because the doctor felt, and he told these two boys that carried him out, he says, well, I can't feel his pulse. And this boy who had fainted popped up and he says, doctor, am I dead? We had more fun out of teasing this young man about that. And but everything was all right. He did just had gotten real warm and hot, and he came on for the second part. And we had many places we'd sing in churches, and the churches would say, now this sanctuary becomes an auditorium if people want to applaud. They felt free to do so. But what we have to do, a lot of times we have to take out benches in the front, because as I told you, we spread our choir out. And I had taught all my people to be able to sing independent on tour, and of course here too. However, on tour, when we carried only around 40 people, they had to know their music and know it backwards and forwards and sing anywhere they were located. And I always had boys that really knew what to do, and of course I would help them, and we'd arrange this and work together. And another thing that was very interesting, the young ladies would always help also. We came to one of the places in the Philadelphia area, and one man came to me and says, this is just like Barman Bailey coming in. Because we brought in quite a bit of equipment. We always carried our risers and all the accessories, and it was quite a job to get things set up and really looking nice. We had people assigned to do certain things, and then the young ladies were always very helpful. In other words, it was just a big family affair where everybody felt that they had to do something. They would even sweep and dust and clean up the piano, and everything just had to be so. We weren't satisfied with a half-baked job. We wanted to do it as fine as possible. And of course, we got quite a bit of a very favorable comment that we weren't sloppy, that we were doing it just as beautifully as possible. And then, of course, we try to sing just as well and do the best possible job. That's about it. I always let my people know that they have to adjust, and not just, I wouldn't take any griping from them. I said, when you leave home and come to college, the cooking of your mother and the cooking of the cafeteria will be different. And I say the same thing, your bed here at the college may not be the same, but you have to learn. This is part of your growing up and becoming educated. And so we didn't hear very much, and in fact, we made it, when we ran into a problem, we laughed about it instead of griping, because I just didn't put up with people always being constant gripers. Well, what can you do about it? And you make the best of the situation.
Okay. Going back to facilities, I think you had said that you had planned everything so well in rehearsal in miniature. What was it you were saying about that?
That's right. What we would do, first here at William & Mary, we knew that we couldn't get into the 5/8 stage, excepting maybe for one rehearsal before our concert. Well, luckily, we've been on tour so much that we were used to a situation like that. However, when we gave our concert at home here in Williamsburg,
we were a little bit more elaborate in our presentation because we had excellent facilities at 5-8, excepting the only objection we had was the rig is some 60 feet, and when we stand back of the curtain, the sound would go up. And so we had to do something, and we had soundboards built so that it would carry the sound out. But what we would do, I would work out in miniature what we are going to do at 5-8. I'd be just like having a skull session. I'd go to the blackboard and show them exactly where everybody's going to stand, what's going to do. And we put it in miniature, and then when we got in 5-8, it just opened up like a rose. And it was just wonderful how these students would adjust. And I would... it would be a terrific job. I had spent a long time figuring out just what they do and had to explain to these people. And as you always have, a few people are a little slower in catching on, but the ones that did, they would shove the other people around, not any harm, but we would walk things through and show them exactly what they're supposed to do, because there were some people who had never been in 5-8 before, some of us who had been, and therefore we had we made the thing work. In other words, I told them, some people would have, I'm sure some choir directors would really have caused a big howl not being able to practice in 5-8. Well, I wasn't very happy about it because it's so much better to practice. Every auditorium has a little different sound also, and the only reason we like to rehearse a couple of days in there so they become accustomed to the sound. So going to tour again, every place we would go, as soon as we'd land, the first thing we would do, even before we check into our motel or our housing assignments, we would go to the auditorium, set up, sing a little bit so they get a feel of the auditorium. I suppose one of the most trying situations I had is nobody's fault. We were delayed in getting to Boston for our concert, and we simply had to let the young ladies go to their housing assignments, and the young men went and set up the stage, and luckily the young men did a little singing, and when we had the warm-up, we always had a warm-up session for our concert. These young men told them, and I told the young ladies too, that this is a dead auditorium, even they're going to have a hard time hearing and so on. And of course what we did, we set our risers in a way that the students could hear each other, but all of them couldn't. And I will never forget the first number we sang. It was sort of like a football team getting the kickoff and fumbling on a 2-yard line and having 98 yards to go for a touchdown. After we sang that first number, I went just to walk around the group, and I told them, I said, "You see what kind of auditorium we have? We've got a real problem to do. Now let's rise to this. We can make it go." And the next number got better, and as the concert went along, things got better. In other words, instead of letting them all freeze and wilt, we just had a little pep talk among ourselves. And at intermission, of course, we exchanged ideas about how we're going to do this and this, and we improved all the way through the concert. In other words, what I'm trying to tell you is everybody knows anybody who's ever done anything in choir work. You've got to learn to adapt, just like you have to learn to adapt to anything that you're doing in your lifetime. But on going on tour, we would usually ask the sponsors to send us the dimensions of the auditorium or the place that we sang or where we would be placed. Several delightful things that we had on the tour. We sang in a church at the Lewinsville Presbyterian Church in McLean, Virginia, and we sang one number, the Dan Baverdi, which is a double choir, and we had the organist of the church to play that. And this was just to show you how well everybody was trained. We sent the score to the organist, who worked out his registrations, and of course the choir knew the music very well. And we landed there in the early afternoon and went through the number one time, and we sang it for the concert, and they did a very fine job. And of course I had to discuss with the organist just what we do, went through the score with him. When we sang in Ridgewood, New Jersey, we had a guest organist, and we did the Tavit Matur, but Kulak, I think, was the one that we did there. And that was very interesting, too. And unfortunately, we didn't get a recording of the Ridgewood, New Jersey, but we did get a recording of the Tadam by Verdi and McLean. And so the students have had just a wide variety of experiences in singing in various places. They were instructed that they were going to run into situations. You don't have always a setup like you have at 5-8 here in Williamsburg.
I believe you had mentioned that there have been a number of people who have helped the choir out over the years who aren't choir connected exactly.
Yeah. Well, when I came here in 1945, the first concert we gave, we had quite a problem. We had no rises. Incidentally, the rises that we have now were mostly bought by our choir through its concerts. We felt that we should do something for ourselves instead of always going over to the administration asking for money. And you know yourself that anything that you earn yourself, you enjoy a little bit more than having everything given to you. I guess part of this is due to the fact that I've always been a poor boy, and I had everything that I did, I had to make for myself. And when I would earn enough money that I could buy myself a suit, I was very proud of that. And I wanted them to be proud, and they were. But the first year, 1945, we didn't have any rises, so I asked some of the young men if they knew any places where we could find any kind of benches, anything. Well, we had a few football boys on the team on our choir, and so they said, "Yeah, we got some kind of boxes out there at Carey Field," and they went out and we built up our rises. And this concert was given in 1945, and then in 46, and years after that. In the old 5-8, eventually we got enough money so we could buy us a few rises. And then I think it's 1947 when Mr. Albert Hawk came to the college, and he was a true friend of our choir and chorus, and he just contributed immeasurably to our staging and the lighting and also recording. He was just, we just thought of him as the choir. And of course, everybody called him Al, and he was very generous and very willing to help. And then when we moved into the new 5-8 in 1957, he helped us again, and he was really the one that suggested we fix these soundboards, and they had been just invaluable to us, because the first time we sang 5-8, just to rehearse, these students said we can't hear each other because the sound went up the rig, Al said, "Well, let's build us some of these movable soundboards," and they have worked wonderful. And a lot of people have been using those, and I assume they're still being used now. We would do a few little showmanship jobs, and. We just ask Al. We'd always try to give him as much help as possible. And of course, he had some of his students who would help. And it was very interesting to work on some of these projects. Oh, man, we would work on them very hard. And Al's always been, even though as time went on and his load was getting heavier and heavier in the theater department, we would ask him, how would we do this? He knew how to do anything. I never saw a man who, he'd always know what to do, and if we'd ever have everything ready on time, and of course we'd spend hours and hours preparing things, because we weren't, as I say, I hate to use this word sloppy, but we would try to be as professional as we possibly could. We were a bunch of amateurs, but the thing, if you don't have a high goal, what you set for, you're never going to hit the mark. So this is one of the things, and Mr. Hawk was very much interested in our success, and we attribute a lot of our success in staging to what all he did. And In the last few years, Mr. Sherman had charge of the 5-8, and he would assign people to our contest lighting and also stage managers. We had our own stage managers, but for the general overall stage manager, 5-8. Then, in the last few years of my work, there was Mr. Chris Bowles, and he is really a fine young man, and did an awful lot of, and he was so willing to help us. And the last few concerts we gave, there were Mr. Bull had Susan Dandridge and David Douglas, and those two people contributed an awful lot to the success. We'd work out our lighting and our staging and our appearance and so forth. And it's just wonderful to be able to work with people who are interested in what we're doing and who are willing to help make a thing just as beautiful as possible. Both to the eye, and of course we try with the singing to make it beautiful to the ear. So then those people were helpless, but we had a young man, I'll never forget one day I was walking across the campus and the young man stopped me and he says, "I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina. I was home for Christmas and we saw your TV performance." I didn't know him from Adam, and I said, "Well, who are you?" And he introduced himself, and I forgot his name. And then a little bit later in the year, I saw him again. I found out it was Wilfred Cale, and I'm sure that many people know him. And well, whereas Wilfred never did sing with us, he was very much interested in the choir, of course, and he did quite a bit for us. He helped us with writing, and he writes very well. He's connected with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and he helped us with the brochure. He helped us with the narration. And he was always willing to lend a hand. He even, once in a while, helped us put up risers and sweep the floor, and because he was interested in the students, and the students got to know him and got to like him. And so we had people like that. And then we would have sometimes some young men and also some girls who would, young ladies, I should say, who would help us along with different things. We had a young man by the name of Willie Jones who wanted to sing with us, but he said he didn't know whether or not he could afford the time, but he would come over and help us with the rises. We had the young ladies from various sororities like the Alpha Chi Omega and the Alpha Kappa Alpha Thetas, and different sororities who would serve as box office people and ushers. So in other words, we had quite a few people who were very, very generous in giving us help and encouraging us and, of course, clapping for us and all of that. we used to have a lot of fun together, and we enjoyed them. We hope they, and we think that they enjoyed us. We had quite, at the moment I can't do it, had so many people who would help. The little details that we wanted, we had people also who would help us with making poster screening, make screen posters. And then of course, in the last few years that we were married, I had a student by the name of Kevin Walters who was very artistic, and he did quite a bit of our poster work. And when we didn't have somebody, we tried to train them to do the job. We had fine stage managers. I would talk over our needs, and they'd have ideas, and I'd have ideas, and we'd pool them. And we would try to make our settings just as beautiful as we knew how. The one young man who made a miniature of the 5-8 stage for me, and a miniature of our rises and our individuals. And of course I was teased that I was playing with my dolls all the time. Well, that's all right, they can say whatever they want to. But this way we knew what to do, and I would work out a formation, as we call them, and then write the names in So they, I'd mimeograph these sheets and give them to the students. We learned very quickly where the world would be placed. What we did, I can't remember if I mentioned this before, we sang what we call formation singing. This had many values. One thing, it gave the audience a relief from seeing the same picture all the time. It also changed the students from how we're standing next to each other. It required of the student to really know his part, that they didn't lean on somebody. It really was quite invaluable to do this. Of course, as I have always mentioned in our conversation, there were some people who always criticized. I didn't even care, after all. I always told my students when they went on stage, you do the best you can, and if anybody can do any better, we'll let them have our place. And that's the way I felt about what I was doing as a director and leading this on. We didn't try to take away from the music. That was our prime interest, to do the music just as beautifully and as well as we knew how, with the talent that we had and also the talent of the director. Can I mention
that? Yes, you.
Now, I mentioned the other day that we were always trying to give a very solid program. We did music from the masters, sacred and secular. We always try to include, particularly in the last years of my work here, a large work so that the students would get a knowledge of some of the fine, large, longer works. However, we try to limit the longer works to about not more than 30 minutes because the audience, a lot of the people in the audience would get restless. The only real long work that we did that occupied the whole night was, of course, the Messiah. I would just like to mention some of the larger works that we did, because this is, and these are not done in any particular chronological order. They're just a few of them that I noted down. We did two Spanish numbers, the Navidad Nuestra by Ramirez, and also the Misa Criolla by Ramirez. Then you did the Magnificat that the young ladies did by Porpora, and a Missa Brevis by Britton. That's for young ladies. We did the Peaceable Kingdom of Thompson, Be Not Afraid for double chorus for Bach, Come Jesu Come, double chorus for Bach, God's Time is Best is a cantata, Leave Us Leader by Brahms, For Everything There is a Season by Rotza, Mass in G by Schubert, I Wrestle and Pray, double chorus for Bach, Gott ist mein König by Bach. We did quite a few opera numbers we'd have just a whole section of opera music. We did the Te Deum double choir by Verdi, the Detentem Te Deum by Handel, In the Beginning by Copland, and the four choruses from the Catullus Carmina by Orff, and the Chichester Psalms by Bernstein, and the Sea Charm by Pickett. Now, those are just a few, and I just jotted those down, and the amazing thing, they always had those memorized. Of course, I mentioned some before about Poulenc that we did, and we did this, spoke about this earlier, recording.
Did the students find it more difficult sometimes? I think you said this, sometimes it was more difficult to sing a well-known number than to learn some of this more difficult classical music, which is less familiar.
Yes, that's true. There was really nothing that they couldn't conquer. I had this theory about my work too, is that anything that I could do, they would be able to do. In other words, you find, and there's no criticism of the directors. I know exactly how a director feels. They look at a piece of music, and, for example, I looked at the Chichester Psalms, and at first it sort of scared me. It was very difficult. The second movement is just I just sometimes felt like we would never get it. But the thing is, we had the motivation we had among those students, they were not going to give up. Come what a hell of a high water, they're going to learn it. And they did it from memory, and they did a fine job of it. And we haven't talked about the Common Glory, but we will. But there were two numbers that the Common Glory Choir did that our William Mary Choir never did, because the Common Glory Choir was really a semi-professional group, because they were really highly trained, more highly trained than the ones we have at William Mary. The Mass in G by Poulenc, and then the Te Deum by Kodaly, and really are quite difficult to do. I almost gave up on Mass in G with my Common Glory Choir, but they were determined, and we did that also from memory. We only had 30 voices, and the spread of the chords and the dissonance and so forth were just absolutely, sometimes we just didn't think that we would get it, but just through determination, hard work, we did it. I just believe that sure, you have to have talent with which to work, but you still have to have a desire and a willingness to work. And if you do that, you're not going to have, I don't think you're going to have much trouble in doing anything, really. Of course, there's some things that we just, a person just doesn't have the skill or the talent or whatever you want to call it. But usually people who work in music are willing to go after it. I've had so many students tell me, oh, I can't sing. Well, one reason they do this is that they maybe have never been challenged or never been encouraged. And I think that the one thing that has pleased me so much, I don't remember if I had said this in a previous conversation, but I had a young lady who came to William & Mary that had never sung much in high school, but she wanted to sing, so she went into the chorus, and where we started all our young ladies, and she did quite well, and she took voice work. And when she got to be in her junior and senior years, she was in the choir, and she became our soloist. And it was really wonderful to see this young lady's voice grow and become a soloist and have control, and really the audiences were really amazed.
Okay. When we were mentioning auxiliary helpers of the choir, I believe there was a gentleman who composed some special music for your choir.
Yes. When I was going to Columbia, working on my doctor's degree, my advisor was Dr. Harry Robert Wilson. And he was very much impressed with the William & Mary Choir. In fact, he had come down here and visited with us and directed the group, and often in some of the classes he would mention about some of the things that our choir would do and how well they were trained. And they had, he was very, very proud of the group. So he told me in 1950, when I finally did receive my degree, that he was going to compose a song and dedicate it to us. And he did a Christmas song called The Children of God. And we sang that. And then in the later years, in 1966, he said he'd like to do another song for us, and it was called The Heart Replies. So these were written and dedicated to the choir and to me, which we, of course, we are glad that somebody liked us that much. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that.